I've spent much of my professional life since the early 80s talking about presidential elections, largely because somebody gave me a reel of videos of ads and told me to write a paper about it for a convention. And I started with that and negative advertising, and then slowly expanded to a series of other kinds of topics. As I have mentioned the other day, that I've spent an awful lot of my life since then answering the single question, what happened to American politics when electricity came? I've been very interested in the use of newsreels for presidential purposes, and especially with the coming of sound, with our Iowa's very own Herbert Hoover as a president who had to struggle with sound and picture, and in the early periods, the place of radio in casting Franklin Roosevelt and empowering his presidency when he was being strongly resisted by Congress, and then mostly in the age of television. And on campaigning and on such things as Bill Clinton. I miss Bill Clinton a lot, because I got to write about Clinton and presidential scandal just about every other week. It was very nice. And finally, then, as the media evolve, move into the internet, and that certainly will be the theme. If you hang on and get to the backside of the handout and get to the questions or some of the implications, the entertaining part is perhaps, with any luck at all, the web campaign and engaged citizens and the use of looking at different kinds of sources, web-based sources for analyzing audiences, attracting audiences, and for political audiences themselves becoming communicators. And then finishing with political, social, and moral consequences. The larger frame is point one on the handout, which is that as electrified media came to politics, they began to affect the way politics was carried out, and more important, the way people thought about politics. And that's the part that gets into the emphasis on the kind of research center I run at the University of Iowa on media studies and political culture. It is the shift in political culture that often is being driven by the use of media. As I suggest here, I brought on video, but I don't want to take the time to show them, because I want you to be able to get out of here while it's still light. Pieces of the first campaign film, Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal, as he was called. He didn't talk much. Silent film was perfect for him. A woman once said to him, I bet I can make you say three words, and he said, "You lose." And they had to do something with him to enliven him, and silent film was his medium. It was the first film they made. It was made by William Fox of later 20th Century Fox, a major film production company, and it brought film in. Television comes in most strongly, as I suggest here, with Eisenhower's 1952 ads, the first president to use advertising. And he didn't just use advertising. Again, he hired the best. Walt Disney was doing his cartoon-based advertising. Irving Berlin was writing the music for his ads. The Republicans, as always, had money and invested it strongly in that first ad campaign. While his opponent, Adlai Stevenson, called up his campaign manager and said, "I need my television man." He was very excited. He thought he was going to make an ad. He said, "No, I want him to fix my television set. I can't see." Didn't use it, and that wasn't the reason he lost, but it's indicative of an attitude toward a medium whose time was not quite there, but was coming very fast. The first YouTube ad, I mean, if we got time later, we can go out and look at it. Appeared in 2006. It is that the use of YouTube is that new as we get into the computer world, by a man who called himself N.J. Weidman, N.J. for New Jersey, Weidman for the Marijuana Party, for which he was a candidate, using YouTube to do his television ads. Of course, since it was free. But it is, as I say, that new. The one of the large points is point two, that if you don't mind being a bit reductionistic, you can kind of argue that political rhetoric across this use impact of electricity in the 20th century in American campaigning shifts its focus from those first films, which are candidate-centered and controlled. The candidates made those films. The candidates picked when they would do their radio interviews. The candidates picked decided if and when they were going to be filmed in other sorts of ways. They did. They made films, and say Coolidge's films were shown in theaters. He made a campaign film of 18 minutes, it was taken around the country and shown in theaters. Hoover was more creative. He put his films in the back of trucks, where the backside was a screen, and put a projector inside and used then what we call rear projection to show the film on the back of the truck that they could drive from town to town. If they lasted, I wish he'd had popcorn. His film was 45 minutes long. Master of Emergencies, the man who'd saved Europe, you'll be happy to know, after World War I, and fed everybody, and now then was ready to lead the country, if they only knew the Depression was going to hit when he was president. The first film to be broadcast, Ronald Reagan, caused great controversy. Only one of the three major U.S. networks showed it in all its entirety. The other two broke it up carefully because they knew it was an advertisement and they weren't about to give away free time in American commercial systems. But anyway, in all of those cases, the film then and the candidate are attempting to control the message with very little resistance. Yet, once we get to the heyday of network TV, as I suggest, we then get into the contestation between the candidates or the parties and the networks. The media-centered and controlled system begins to come in, where radio stations and television stations, thanks to American commercialism, ask for money if they're going to show pictures of the candidate. If they're going to have their conventions there, they have to agree to let the news networks sit in little boxes high above the arena, their cameras picking what they will shoot, what they will show, and at least half the time or more showing the commentators talking about the conventions rather than showing the conventions themselves. And the candidates in turn saying, how can we get messages out without spending money? What can we do that will count as newsworthy rather than as a paid political pitch? And the struggle was on. What I suggest and see is that by the time we get to this era, by the time we get here, we are beginning to move in election 2008, campaign 2008 is the main marker. We're beginning to move to a third phase, and that of citizen-centered and controlled media. We're by no means there. As I suggest, when presidential candidates raise $1.6 billion, that's billion with a big B, that's even a lot of euros. When that happens, obviously they have a tremendous leverage in the system. And yet, thanks to the internet, we're getting a situation where citizens are able to generate pieces of political information, opinion, and advice, and in enough numbers, in enough size, if you will, to be a significant factor in the election. It doesn't win or lose elections yet. But it has taken on such a significant position that it could in the very near future. That'll be the framework within which we work. I won't spend time on the evolution of the use of the internet, except maybe to point out that Bill Clinton in 1992 is the first to use the internet. He used simple listservs to send messages out to his campaign staffs across the country on a daily basis, saying, here's what's happening, here's what's with us, tell me what you've got going on with you and what help you kinds of need, that you need. And then, of course, after he's elected, as you all know, Al Gore invents the internet, or so some say. That the Clinton administration put serious money into the construction of the central spine that will improve the functioning of the internet and began it to give it the kind of capabilities that lead to the digital age, the ability to manipulate, to hyperlink, and any number of other kinds of things that come with making the big pipe a lot bigger and changing some of its electronics in ways I couldn't possibly tell you. Okay, and then once that begins to happen, then we're talking in the mid-90s, candidates themselves begin launching websites. 1996, every candidate has websites. On my political culture website, you could find somewhere or other, you can find some of those early websites from 1996, which I painstakingly captured in the primitive technology of the time, at least the front pages, of candidate sites, of good government sites, of opposition sites, of pressure group sites, of Nazis. We have all kinds of things coming up. I saved about 55 front pages to see where it begins, and then election by election, it gets to be more sophisticated. What I really want to do then, actually, is to show you just some of the kinds of materials and sites that became available and of use in the 2008 election. So already we have raced through one and two, and point three. What I'll do is look a little bit at computer-based information and communication systems. The first point, the internet is being used strongly to gather information about the population, its attitudes, its beliefs, its habits, its appetites, its locations, and ways of reaching it. Then move into the more general topic of how the internet gets used by a population, by the citizenry, so-called open source politics. In that phrase, the notion that anybody, thanks to that open source idea, can become a political activist, a political agent, yea, a politician, if you will, thanks to the internet, and then deal with social, ethical, and political consequences. So first then, computer-based information and communication systems. This is more or less what you have on the handout, slightly different here and there, because I didn't want to make quite all the divisions on PowerPoint that I had before. But first let me begin with the central notion that is absolutely critical to what the computer does to American politics, and that is the notion of geodemographics. The ability to map people in important kinds of ways. That ability to map people comes in several different forms. Geodemographics, in part, simply is a matter of how people are displayed visually, and I want to show you some of that. But also, as you say, as I suggest under point A, 1, B, and C, you also can literally gather data on individuals in some clever sorts of ways, the most important of which is probably in the U.S., the Claritas system that was started in the mid-80s, Claritas clustering. What Claritas clustering involved was finding out what people in different areas eat, what they drink, what they drive, what they watch, how much they paid for their house, what kind of jobs they have, gathering a series of pieces of information about them demographically, who they are, but as important, and I suspect more important, what they consume. Long ago we said you are what you eat. We are now to the point that you are politically what you eat. You get put into different groups, consumption groups, and on the basis of the kinds of things you consume, the clothing you wear, where you go, how you go on vacation, by what kind of transportation and so on, you get to be typed as a certain sort of person. And those can be sorted by postal code, or what we call zip code. And in the United States, after all, we went not simply from a straightforward postal code now, but to a 9-digit postal code. The first 5 tells you what the general area is. The last 4 digits identify what particular block in a town you live on. Therefore, you can be organized geographically. And then if I take those geographic blocks and overlay them with information about what you eat, drink, drive, and where you go, I can begin to make certain sorts of assumptions about you. Tendencies. So that my zip code where I live is 52361 in the United States. I live outside of Iowa City, about 16 miles. That puts me into a cluster called Grain Belt, indicating I live in an agricultural rural area. I'm likely to have a Winnebago or some great big machine that I drive around for my vacation rather than flying anywhere. It'll indicate what kind of television shows I watch and movies I watch. And again, what kind of where I shop, I'm likely to shop. Given in Grain Belt, I'm going to shop at the big mass distribution and discount stores. I'm not going to go to the boutiques and specialty stores for my clothing. You can already tell that. And on and on and on. Whereas when I was living in Iowa City, I lived at zip code 52240, which put me in a cluster called Town and Gown, indicating that I come out of a professional class, that yes, my children swim in swimming pools, and therefore I have a series of, let's say, urban and city interests, as opposed to those who swim in the rivers where I live. Heaven help them all with the snakes. And on and on. By moving 16 miles, I become a different person, at least theoretically, politically. Then, of course, this information is gathered by what magazines I subscribe to. Every time you subscribe to a magazine, that information is sold to somebody who's going to use it to make a judgment about the kind of person who lives at your address. The computer is allowed amazingly fine tuning. Right now, the Claritas system generally puts people into one of 110 categories. And then you begin to combine them. So I'm going to get the same political mail, at least when I was in Iowa City, as the people living in Santa Barbara, California get. They get in Bloomington, Indiana, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and on to any large university town. They won't send it to my neighbors. They won't send that same mailing out to Grain Belt. They're not going to do that. And then slowly they can find ways to display this information. He said, assuming this work, one of the tools is the choropleth map. This is the simple tool. This, in very broad terms, colors areas and uses the contrasting colors to make simple distinctions. In this case, what percentage of people turned out in any given area? Maybe if I go drop this down a little. So that the little dots there in the middle indicate, as you can see from this scale over here, what percentage of people of particular voting age turned out, and what the colors indicate then are what percentages, whether Bush or John Kerry in 2004 won the area, and if so, by how much. What that information gives you, for example, right there, the yellow strip down the middle, that Iowa, Missouri, and Arkansas are very vulnerable. They went to George Bush, but by a small percentage. So these are going to be places where the campaign is going to be, where they're going to spend more money than they will the others. The same is true of those that are light blue. Those states got special attention from the Republicans as they desperately tried to win back, and at least two of those states, Michigan and Pennsylvania, are major political players. Lots of voters, urban states. So what we get, and in turn, once you get to those brown states, the Democrats are never going to go into Nebraska very much. It's over two-thirds Republican, they know it. It's brown, they like it brown, I'm sure. That's about the color of the landscape as well. Anyway, through this, you're picking up a couple of kinds of information, where to spend money, and where you've got voter apathy. You look at poor West Virginia, Tennessee, and Indiana. Less than half the people roughly voted there. They were able to vote, and as a result, either you ignore them or you go in first with a voter registration program and then come back. All right, those are choropleth maps. The other kind that are interesting, where'd they go? I lost it. Where's my cartogram? I'm going to show off problems. Well, I may have to improvise here. I won't take the time to go find it. Well, maybe I will. Drives me nuts when I can't. A cartogram map, I did it, is a very different kind. Here shows in the great American tradition of red states and blue states how the voters actually look. That's a lot of them are purple. When the mixture of how red or how blue they are. Furthermore, what this map of the United States does is construct the country by size of population. So the big bulge over on that side is California spilling out on the ocean because there are so many people. New England gets awfully big because of New York, Pennsylvania in particular. You can see all the old people go to Florida and have swelled it. And on and on. The tip of Texas, nobody's there. Okay, you are then able to look at such a map, right? And again, those that are the bluest and the reddest are relatively secure, and then the different shades of purple are indicating, at least in a general way. What this allows is for a gross visualization, and I show it largely because it's pretty. So here is the graphing of a population. And if you then add in the information you know about voters, you're able to say, here's where we got a certain percentage of votes. We had these kind of people there. These are the political pitches we'll use to break them free. Okay, to move quickly, we also use focus groups. The politicians will gather 15 people together, show them an ad, and say, what do you think? Prejudging or pre-assessing ad before it goes on the air. And you'll do that as well to find out what issues are more or less important to what kind of people. You usually build focus groups either by trying to get one of every kind of major category, young person, old person, a black person, white person, and on, or you get a concentrated group of a particular area. For example, there were an awful lot of youth groups, people bringing together people under 25 to see if there's anything you can do to stir them politically. Because of voting age people, those that are 18 to 30, actually make up about 22% of the electorate. If they ever voted, it would make a phenomenal difference, could make a phenomenal difference. Public opinion surveys, I won't talk about. Except to indicate that what candidates tend to do is use a rolling public opinion survey. That is, they'll interview 500 people on Monday, 500 people on Tuesday, 500 people on Wednesday, 500 people on Thursday. Now they got 2,000 people. Then on Friday they'll interview another 500 and throw out Monday's 500. And Saturday they'll do another 500 and throw out Tuesdays. So you have a constant survey of 2,000 people, but it's changing. That allows them to chart shifts in a half a percent or a percent pretty accurately, at least comparatively, to look for movements in voters. And candidates are always interested in what kind of people are moving and how fast. And if they're moving, then I'm going to have to move as well on a series of issues. Tracking polls and dial technologies, the kind of poll I was just talking about, the rolling or tracking poll, fits into that. Dial technologies are giving people little machines with a 1 to 7 scale and have them listen to a speech and say if where 1 is strongly disagree and 7 is strongly agree. And then as they're listening, to have them turn the dial. If you have enough people doing that, of course, you're going to chart a rolling opinion that is recording sentence by sentence what the opinions of those with the dials are. Again, you may think that's not particularly accurate, and of course it's not. But the fact that there are changes is what becomes important, because then the campaign can say, what was it that changed, that moved that needle? What was it that moved the line that's scrolling through? Don't say this. I think I'm going to get rid of that. You will then also begin to map where voters are and how they're reached by particular media. So here is a map of media reach in Fort Wayne, Indiana. What this does is identify which counties in Indiana are, and you knew this from audience surveys, are consuming particular television and radio stations broadcasting out of Fort Wayne, Indiana. You'll notice that it doesn't sit on a state line. It goes across a state line. That this tells you that the message you're offering out of that better not talk only about Indiana. It better be something that'll make sense to both some people in Ohio, if anything does, and people in Indiana. And you begin then to chart out these are areas of dominant influence or ADI research that tells you the media reach and then the media, the newspapers, radio, and television outlets that have influence in that area. The whole country is divided into it. You use this to decide on your media bias. So if you've given up on Indiana but still want Ohio, it's possible you'll do something there, or again you may ignore it. That sort of mapping then allows them to visualize I can't do this at the same time. Listserv mailings you all get. Somebody or other's got you on a list and they're going to bombard you with mailings. By the middle of the Iowa caucus period, midsummer in 2007, I was getting internet messages and mailings from about 14 candidates. I had a lot of mail. My postman was quite unhappy with how I was living. That you use those as your secure bases. Then you look for any kind of reaction from you. If you write in and say, I don't want to get that mailing anymore, they are going to write you off. You won't be important. They're not going to spend time on you. Because what they are doing is taking information about everybody in their main databases. The Republican database is now somewhere around 75 million. The Democratic database, just about as many. And if you're talking about the United States with about 168 million voters, that means about 90% or more of the voters are in those databases by name, individually. And they're looking for any indication of your interest in them, because then you will be contacted later again and again with more specialized materials. Another kind, and maybe this belongs in the other categories, I begin to move down into how citizens are reached with listserv meetings and so on. Are ways to try and reach them, if you can, through kinds of humor, political humor. And jibjab.com was one that pioneered in this area. And I want to show you an ad that you will recognize from a slightly earlier. I hope you can hear it.
Oh.
right. And now these were phenomenally popular through the beginning of the 80s. Oh no! Let me out. I don't want to print. Come on. Well, now will you let me out? No. I've got to get out. Escape. Okay. I said, you have to put a Mac user on this. All right. Going quickly, because it's getting late, digital photos. I get them all the time. It now costs some, maybe 2 cents to send me a very nice picture of Barack Obama at the inauguration, plus the mailing, and they have a wonderful picture. And, of course, a little tag that said we could use help in paying for the inauguration attached to it. I have a desk full of very nice photos from all these candidates. Once that became cheap, they could just bombard you with pictures. Data mining, of course, when your computer goes out to a website, you are leaving a cookie behind. And as a result, there's a marker that you've been there. That's an indication of some kind of interest. And if you go more than once, then they're convinced you are interested, and you will then get yourself into the loop for another set of mailings. Or somebody coming to your house, but more about that later. This election in particular, and the candidate websites, I should tell you, are down. So here, though, is what's left of Ron Paul's campaign website. He hasn't given up yet. What you have ahead on everybody's website, down in one of the lower corners, is something like this. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, MySpace. Only there would be a lot more of those than that. During the campaign, they probably have 8 to 10 different places where you could click on and become a member of their team. You could spend your time on Facebook with Ron Paul, or you could Twitter the staff of Barack Obama. Barack Obama, by the time he announced for the presidency in February 2007, had over 500 groups organized on Facebook alone. And that's not counting the groups that are organized on MySpace. Twitter, they weren't Twittering till later in the campaign. He had one invented called 1 Million for Barack, and by June 2007, there were 1 million people in that pile. Overall, he organized some 1.4 million people through social networking. So that, as a single listserv, that would have been a good start. But that many he had actively then engaging. And why the social networking places are important, because you're not simply hooked up to the candidate, but you're hooked up to each other. You begin to move into the world of social judgment, comparative social judgment, so that you will be people like you, who are in the business of forming one of those groups. Each group probably with a different center or a different set of topics it dealt with. Social networking software became one of the most important things that happened in campaign 2008. And I say, now that we'll have Twitter allowing you to keep going, it'll get even worse. This then led to candidate and interest group blogs. You then could spin off, I'll say one of the groups on MySpace or Facebook could spin off, set up its own blog, and sit and talk to each other about how wonderful the candidate was, let you know where the candidate was going to be so you could go look at the candidate. You also, of course, could even use these for dating services, because you have a lot of personal information being loaded into your Facebook site, as well as some of you know. And only once in a while does it come to get you. I'll skip podcasts because they weren't very successful. Only one candidate, Chris Dodd, used podcasts. He would, every time he went out to speak, a little man with a camera would be there to shoot what he was saying, and the next day it would be on a video podcast, so you could go look. You could go on your computer to the podcast, find the Chris Dodd podcast, and look at what he did. More important were the social category podcasts, the podcast being done by those who thought himself as left, as right ideologically. the gay and lesbian podcast, the American for Big Rifles podcast, and any number of these specialized groups that you can find if you go to podcastalley.com and check under either society or under the politics one. The politics one is just a bunch of institutional ones. The ethics and society one is much more interesting. Push polling was used some, not a lot. Push polling is a question where somebody calls up and says they're doing a questionnaire and they'd like you to respond. And of course, what they're really doing are questions like, did you know that JoJo Brown spends his night chasing women in bars? Do you think that's a good idea? They're asking you loaded questions there to give you political information under the guise of gathering information. It is frowned upon, but it's still done. Sim campaigns are simulation campaigns. You move into an area, you move into the sim campaign software, set up a series of variables. You pretty well know, let's say, what Fort Wayne, Indiana has demographically. You lay that out into the computer system, and then you say, if I say X or Y, what will happen? Or if I do X or Y, what will happen? And the program then runs a simulation on potential reaction to what you're doing. They're used much more for local than national campaigns, but they were used in key cities. Fort Wayne, Indiana happened to be one where they were used because Indiana was a state the Democrats were working very hard to get. Fort Wayne, one of the influential areas. Fort Wayne actually saw Bill Clinton four times. That's how good they thought it was. Repersonalization, the last thing I'll do here. Repersonalization is a phrase, something I wrote about after the 2004 election, where all the information that the national parties have can be downloaded into personal data assistance, PDAs, and then carried around by somebody on the ground. So that as the campaign comes near the end, our little person, half of them volunteers, the other half paid, and both campaigns spend a lot of money on bodies in the streets, can walk into a neighborhood and stop at houses 1, 3, 5, 7, and 14, and skipping all the others because it's only in houses 1, 3, 5, 7, and 14 they have information on people they think might vote. They skip the ones they're not sure of because they haven't got time for them. You can't talk to everybody. So, for example, in my own precinct, I live in Grainbelt, in a rural area with not a single town in it, in my precinct. They're all farms. I was given there are 410 registered Democrats, roughly. I was given a list of 223 of them. Those are the ones that we were watching for. That was in the 2004 election. That we had information on would likely vote for John Kerry and not for George Bush. And so you didn't care about the rest of those Democrats. You didn't have time. You cared about 223. And it was my job to get 80% of them to the polls that day. That kind of personalizing in an era, you understand, in an era when you're dealing with something like 225 million voters, right, is an amazing ability to take down to that single person. 168,000 of them registered. The first part then is simply there are a phenomenal number of ways to gather information about you and to package it, and on the basis of that information, try to read you in particular. This gets to that second topic, the promise of open source politics. It is Michael Sifry, as I suggest here, who invented that phrase, open source politics, saying it is, as I suggest in the quotation that I left you with, opening up participation and planning and implementation to the community, letting competing actors evaluate the values of your plans and actions, being able to shift resources away from bad plans and bad planners toward better ones and expecting more of participants in return. It means moving away from egocentric organizations toward network-centric organizing. It is Open source politics then that comes with really two dimensions. One, involving constituencies or citizens in planning processes and in suggesting how to reach voters in their communities, in their areas, and in turn letting them be people who make their own political messages. You turn them loose. You know some will make dumb messages. You know some will do a very clumsy job. But you also know that others, because they are neighbors, will be very, very effective in reaching somebody. It goes back to the classic Lazarsfeld studies of the 1940s, that opinion leaders in your community are much more important than opinion leaders from outside, from another level of government. Never mind. I'll save this for a little bit. He said, "Oh, and I keep forgetting it asked me questions." You've looked at one video collage already. The jib jab. This land is your land. That may be enough. I say video and audio here largely because a lot of video collages were pulled off the internet when large suits were aimed at them for taking stock footage from new networks and other places and making into collages. And it's too bad because there used to be phenomenal ones. But one way you can participate is make things for YouTube and stick them up and let them rip. A site I want to show you is techpresident.com. This is, again, much of this is pulled down, but I can go to archives and show you some. Techpresident.com was a kind of listserv you could subscribe to keep track of what was happening in the campaign. Some of the archives left from the campaign are still up. The number of supporters different candidates had on Facebook. If you look at something like this, and they give you the numbers for good measure. Barack Obama has 2,400,000 supporters on Facebook alone. John McCain got a little over 500,000, and then they began to string down. The tremendous bulge that he developed, and you can see it starts. The first measure they had was in May 21st, 2007. He's announced about 3 months before then. They're starting to build. And then once he gets into the summer, the curve begins just to rip up as folks begin to realize they can find him there and join his campaign. Technorati, counting the number of mentions on blogs that candidates got. Here you go with all candidates. These are, and again, you will see, if you can look at the numbers, the sheer numbers, Obama's getting almost 12,000 to McCain's 7,000. Everybody, I mean, those are positive and negative mentions on a series of blogs that have been identified. And then you begin to notice the points at which they peak. As you get to the end of 2007, you're building hard into the Iowa caucus, which was on January 4th, 2008. And you can see Obama's little light blue peaking. There's a lot of interest as well in McCain that is developing in this period. But then you'll notice that Obama keeps up as the spring moves through. A lot of mentions, McCain's begin to fall. Sarah Palin comes in. You can tell exactly when she comes in. She has her flaming day-glow color to let her know that she comes in then and gives the Republicans a boost. But keeping track here of mentions of candidates. So you can track who mentioned and when. This one becomes important only because you get other people that are. Meetup technology was sold yesterday. That was a 2004 technology that candidates used to hook people together to tell them when meetings were and when to come. Obama still used that technology and got Here, though, an independent presidential candidate, a hyper-conservative candidate, Barr, is using that technology to try and gather people together. It becomes one of the only ones that show somebody else using a technology to make a difference. Anyway, what you get on techpresident.com are counting of everything. Internet hits, blog hits, Facebook, you saw them, Twitter gets on by now, and so on, allowing you to chart when candidates, very useful to scholars, when candidates, what candidates are having impacts when and how. I'll skip flash mobs, it's getting late. Because flash mobs weren't really used. Flash mobs were except we had something like flash mobs, so I put it on here. Flash mobs, of course, are people who are told to gather at a particular time in a particular place and do something, whether it's lie down on the ground or have a pillow fight, do it for 4 minutes and then go someplace else.
Right.
To disperse. The bringing, these are, for those of us raised in the 60s, what we would have called happenings. But now they're flash mobs. You don't assemble crowds in quite that way, but similarly, as I suggested in my lecture a couple days ago, that when you want to gather an audience for a speech in a big place, you use the same range of connections. You use listservs, you use cell phones, short message systems to bring people together. That's the only way you get 50,000 Iowans to go to one place, to go to Des Moines to hear a speech. That was the only way you'd get 200,000 to go to Tiergarten in Berlin to see Barack Obama. You need to call in that many. These are the kinds of things that were used in the World Trade Organization protests and those sorts of things to gather in big hunks of populations to have a grand event. 100,000 people into a North Carolina football stadium for Obama. Obviously his campaign was masterful at doing precisely that. Another form then, and so here you are using, citizens are using the technology to build crowds to get things done. By collective blogs, I mean those that sit online and become institutionalized. The Daily Kos was a liberal blog that became institutionalized. It keeps track daily of Obama's favorable rating as much as it can. It follows elections. Earlier today, the lead story was the death of Ted Kennedy. By now, looking for already at his replacement. And on will be news stories and commentary from the left. From the right, as I mentioned, was something like Patrick Buchanan's townhall.com, a right political daily commentary that circulates in fair numbers. Daily Kos is the sixth largest information service in the United States in terms of number of people who consume a single source. It's important. This election, it was the Huffington Report that took over much of that role as well. You know enough about MySpace, Facebook, and YouTube to do that, to get by that. So let me skip those. As I said, because those campaign sites aren't really campaign sites anymore, except for Ron Paul. And Hillary Clinton actually keeps a corner of hers alive. You never know when you're going to need another Clinton. It's always there, always there. I'd rather get to the consequences and leave some room for Pentelis here. What I suggest are, I think, some quite serious political, social, and moral consequences. The political consequences for some people have much to do with surveillance. How can I stop people from gathering and solidifying information about me in a package? What can I do to cut them off? We now have a phone number, an internet site we can go to for donotcall.com, trying to keep anybody soliciting from via telephone. And unfortunately, you can't stop them on the cell phone network, but you can at least stop them on your landlines. And if they don't stop, you get to call in and blow the whistle and have a very good time. That's one of the blocks. You can try not to spend time on Facebook, because especially if you bite and take a gift from anybody, you've opened your whole Facebook page to anybody else who's searching by your name can find you and find out personal information about you. You can try to do some blocking. You can refuse to register to vote or something as well. But political surveillance and the gathering of citizen information in systematic ways, especially in the context of 9/11, and especially in the context of 9/11, which always suggests to most Americans that that information is going to be not simply centered in a corporation, but centered as well in some government bureau. That somebody or other will know an awful lot about you. They already know about your taxes. They already know about your Social Security. They already know a bunch of things about you. This would give them more information. Political surveillance is one of the consequences, and a serious one. Micro-targeting. That if you, in fact, like Claritas, divide a population into 110 groups, you have broken the body politic apart. You have aimed particular messages at particular segments rather than asking a population to understand issues in broader sorts of ways. It allows you to say, I'm going to vote for them only if they're for or against a mother's right to choose, for example, or only on this issue, or only on that issue. And as I've said to others, it has become very easy in American politics where a population says, the issues are way too hard for me to understand. I don't understand economics. I don't understand what health plan really is best for the whole country. But by God, I know what's right or wrong. And I know abortion is wrong. And I know that taking my guns away is wrong. And I know that letting somebody who's killed a child stay alive is wrong, and on and on. The moral issues tend to slide into those slots, and they become great grounds for micro-targeting. And you've heard it in the healthcare. Don't let Obama's plan go through because he's going to kill your grandma. And you get an appeal like that, a fear appeal attached. It becomes the only issue you use to judge whether we should move and alter the healthcare system of the United States. That's scary stuff. Micro targeting breaks you, fragments the country in complete ways. It also then leads to the heightening and suppressing of issues. That is, so early in 2007, about all candidates talked about was the immigration issue the beginning of an Iraq issue. And those two issues dominated. And then later, as though nothing happens there, candidates don't get sorted out, then later they move into the economic issues as it becomes obvious that things are happening in American economics. And other issues get suppressed. So campaigning starts, for example, in the state of Iowa. That's where it begins, in my home. Iowa's a rural state. What gets talked about are rural issues. The cities of the East and the West get very angry because urban issues aren't talked about by the candidates for that most of that first year of campaigning. They simply aren't there because they're not relevant to those rural audiences that start the electoral process. And, of course, always we get the difficulty in deciding the difference between campaigning and governing. Can a person move from a campaign mode, strongly promotional mode, and into a governing mode? And can you suddenly become trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent, for those of you who are Boy Scouts? Or are you going to campaign? Are you going to judge your policy decisions by what effect they'll have on your popularity or what they might do to the country? A difficult question. Because the Obama campaign for re-election had to start within a couple of weeks of when he was elected. David Axelrod had to once again fire up his system and begin to think how various scenarios might play if he did A or B or C as President of the United States. The social consequences then are related. The clustering or fragmentation of America as well. If you begin to divide the country into clusters of particular interests based on what kind of milk you drink, then you are in a very odd situation of not being able to think and talk about the needs of a total population, about all strata of society, all socioeconomic groups, people of different ethnic backgrounds, ages, and so on. Furthermore, it seems to me another important implication of what I've been talking about is the question of whether the internet comes as a tool of empowerment or disengagement. Does it come to say you too can be a political activist, a political actor? You too can send in electronic messages. You too can create a blog. You too can build a social network around a particular idea or set of ideas and maintain it on Facebook, in that sense empowering you? Or does it so bombard you with millions of messages, with political humor, attack mode, usually in some sort of attack mode, that disengages you from the political process? That the rise of cynicism in the face of not only humor, but also fear appeals and other kinds of attack are very well documented. And the internet simply increases the speed with which that sorts of material moves through the country. And so whether this technology then is in fact empowering or disengaging becomes moot. The fact that the United States had far more voters registered than ever before and yet didn't set a record in the election because the Republicans were so disengaged that they didn't come out to vote in significant numbers. And keep in mind, Obama wins that election, yes, in part by increasing the Democrat vote, but in part because the Republican vote is suppressed. An indication that there's something going on through all this material. And that leads then finally to the moral consequences, that you come potentially with the internet being so individualized in how you work, so purposive, in breaking you down into small groups, that you end up with the disuniting rather than the uniting of the country. We may talk of a wired nation, but we're all in different wires. And that makes a big difference in its ability to mold a body politic together. It allows us to increase the blame game because more negative messages flow, to potentially increase gridlock. Politicians don't dare move on an issue for fear that there'll be a roar of voices coming up on the internet that'll then get picked up by the television networks, CNN or Fox in particular, and then become issues upon which they're judged. It may produce gridlock. The third moral consequence, the revenge of the nerds, is there only because it bleeds into the last point. And that is that you are, for better or worse, subjected to the people that design the system of wires. Right. The information that comes to you because of the kind of computer you have, the kind of site you go to, and how you're kept track of allows information to be quarantined, to be controlled, to be sent or not in very particular kinds of ways. It leads to what some have called the second enclosure movement. If the first enclosure movement we blame on Alan's friends in Great Britain, of taking all the land in the country and carefully putting it into little boxes created by hedges and rocks and saying who could use which piece how, with a relatively small percentage of that land being left in commons, in that which belongs to everyone, that we have perhaps something similar going on with the internet. Yes, you live in the commons. You can get on the internet free and ride around town. But there are parts of that information you have absolutely no access to that lives in California in Googleplex, that complex of buildings where all messages sent everywhere in the United States and maybe the world, we don't know, are kept in archives. You don't know who has access to the archives, who can buy their way in, that's unclear. And this is the ground for many an action movie, if you keep working at it. The fact that this can be done, that things about you, said by you, and for you are kept in places you have no access to, but others do, while you just think you're playing and having a good time on the internet, leads then ultimately to phenomenally important moral questions. Is the question you may want to call the internet free, but it comes with a series of consequences. As I said, We're at that point where, as Alvin Toffler said, we cannot cram the world of tomorrow into yesterday's cubbyholes. We are reinventing a political system. It's not reinvented yet. These take time. They go across time. Yet it's happening. And we live potentially with a series of political, social, and moral consequences that you're going to have to deal with. Yea, indeed, in the world of Nokia. Thank you very much.